Hello, everyone. I'm Greg Goins from the Reimagine Schools podcast, a proud member of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to right now. The opinions expressed are those of the individual host. Make sure you check out all the other great podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com and get ready because the learning begins in 3, 2, 1.
Hey, today I'm talking with Dr. Barbara Oakley. Barb is an author, speaker, professor, engineer, and adventurer. She's worked in some unique situations. She's been an officer in the U.S. Army Signal Corps. She's worked in Antarctica and on a Soviet fishing trawler where she translated Russian and English. But today we're talking about her most recent book, Learning How to Learn, How to Succeed in School Without Spending All Your Time Studying. It's an amazing tool that not only is it for kids, I got to tell you something, parents, teachers, and school administrators should read this too. You're going to love today's talk. Thanks for being here. Enjoy.
You are listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast for educators, helping you help kids achieve their dreams. And now here's Steve with this week's show.
Dr. Barbara Oakley is an author, speaker, professor, engineer, and adventurer. Just take a look at her Twitter. She is a female Indiana Jones. Barbara is the author of numerous books, two of which, Mind Shift, Breakthrough Obstacles to Learning and Discover Your Hidden Potential in 2017, and A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science. By the way, love this part. Even if you flunked algebra. Published in 2014, have been translated into more than a dozen languages. Barbara has a cool educational background. Check this out. PhD in Systems Engineering, Master of Science in Electrical and Computer Engineering, Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering, Bachelor of Arts in Slavic Languages and Literature, graduate of the United States Army Signal Corps Officer Course, Fort Gordon, Georgia, graduate of the Defense Language Institute, Monterey, California. But wait, there's some really cool stuff coming if you didn't think that was cool enough. She met her husband working as a radio operator, check this out, at the South Pole Station in Antarctica. Now, is that cool or what? She worked as a Russian translator for several fishing seasons. Yeah, you heard me right. Several fishing seasons on Soviet fishing trawlers in the Bering Sea. Barbara wrote a book about this experience. It's called Hair of the Dog, Tales from a Russian Trawler. Her current work focuses on the complex relationship between neuroscience and social behavior. Barbara is published in outlets as varied as the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. Her research has been described as revolutionary in the Wall Street Journal. She and her husband have been married for 33 years and have two daughters and two adopted sons from Kosovo. Barb, thanks so much for joining me today. Say hi to everyone.
Hello, everyone. Steve, thanks so much for having me on the show.
Oh, it's great to have you here. And before we go any further, you have such an incredible background. Let's talk about working on a Soviet trawler and meeting your husband at South Pole Station. Could you do that for me?
Let's see. Well, you know, it seems like everything that happened, it's always kind of like a bit of a fluke. It's like, oh, well, that seems kind of cool. Let's try that. And working on the Soviet trawlers, it just turned out there was this little company based out of Seattle where I had returned to go to the university for my second degree when I was deciding to try to retrain my brain and learn math and science. And so I would study engineering really, really hard for like 6 months. And then my brain would just fry. And I'd say, I just can't take it anymore. And there was this job available where you could work as a Russian translator up on the Bering Sea and off the coast of the Pacific Northwest on Soviet trawlers. They needed an American to translate when the other Americans on American ships were actually working with the Soviets. So you know, they would the Americans would radio me on the Soviet vessel and they'd say unprintable words to the effect of "please slow the boat down," and then I would translate that into more printable Russian and say, you know, you have to be just right. What was happening was the Soviets would catch fish with their big flash freeze at sea, the Americans would catch the fish with their small catcher boats, and then they pass it off to the Soviets. Soviets who had these great big flash freeze at sea trawlers. And as it turned out, there was a change in rules. So the Soviets couldn't catch the fish, but the Americans could. So if the Americans passed it off to the Soviets could process it. And because the Americans didn't have flash freeze at sea capabilities. And so anyway, I ended up on the Soviet trawlers doing these translations and trying to get the Americans and the Soviets to work together, which was really a job sometimes, because the Soviets would be all their evil capitalist pigs, you know. And the Americans are like, oh, they're just commies. And, you know, they're each hating each other, and they're fishermen to boot, which nice. Is, we're talking wild people. And so it was a very interesting experience. And then my brother had worked down in Antarctica, and he said, you know, you've got some military background as a radio operator. Why don't you apply? There's a radio operator position opening up at the South Pole Station. And I thought, boy, that just sounds really cool. You know, forgive the yes, it was really cool. It was minus 73 degrees Fahrenheit when we landed, and that was not even counting wind chill. And so people were getting frostbite just walking from the plane to the station. And it was such an interesting experience, you know, not the least of which I met my husband there. And that, of course, makes me always say I had to go to the end of the earth to meet that man. But even just you, like if you took a shower and you walked outside with your hair still wet, all of a sudden it was you'd start making all these little tinkling sounds because your hair would freeze and you'd just be walking around with a head full of icicles. So it was a really fun experience, but I think all of it led, each step led in some inexorable way to the next.
That's so cool. Yeah, here I go using that same word again. It's just so cool. You know, what's funny is just about the freezing hair and the what you're talking about. There's a great picture of your husband on your website.
Yes. Yep. Yep. I have to say, he is my hero. He can do anything. And at that time, I think it was around minus 100 and some. And then with wind chill, it was like down below minus 170 or something. And he was only out for about 10 minutes, and they took a picture of him. But he would work – when we were at the pole, he would work outside all day, and then he'd come in, and you could eat anything you wanted down at the pole. It was all in the, you know, the freezer, which is the outside. And he would eat like – oh, let's see. Let's have three roast ducks, and we'll have five baked potatoes with all the works. And I mean, he would just eat maybe 10,000 calories a day, no problem. And he was thin as a rail, and so it's funny how things work down there.
It's just, I can't even imagine the temperature, nor the thought about trying to eat, nor trying to do anything other than stay warm.
Yes, yes.
And plus, there's a lot of people down there, right?
Let's see, there were about 70 people on the South Pole Station when we were there. We were there during the so-called summer season. Uh-huh. So it actually got up to minus 20 or so. So nice. It was a balmy minus 20. And I know you're going to laugh, but it was a dry cold. And so it actually wasn't bad. You could go out and in the radiant heat of the sun, and remember, it was sun 24 hours a day there because wow. It was during the summertime. And I would even go out in like a sweatshirt and go running or something like that, because the radiant heat was really not too bad. And I could run around the world in 3 seconds. Okay. Just going on the pole.
Nice. That's now you're starting to sound like a cartoon. This is that's I think I've seen this cartoon. So where you're located, easily, you're just literally you could say I'm here. I am here. I am here. I am here. I am now. I've gone around the world. Hey.
Yep. And they even had a round the world race. It was a 3-mile race. They set up this little course and you just run around it three times. It was 1 mile. And it was a round the world race. And so, of course, I was probably one of the last finishers. But, you know, it felt kind of fun to go around the world three times in this race.
Yeah, that would kind of change the story of you know, the world around the world in 88 days or whatever, that around the world in 80 days type thing.
Yeah,
it didn't take us that long. What's your problem, man? That's why I was commenting. So we're all 70 people in, you know, kind of like in the same area. Are you all running into each other, or that's what I meant by there's not,
but... there were like Quonset hut or sort of a barracks. So at that time there was a dome, and there were like these, you know, the containers that are in the back of trucks. They had a bunch of these container like things, and so they wedged us in. That was the barracks, and I had a cot in a little room that I shared with a roommate. So I had the upper bunk. And it just usually, so for example, I often work nights, and so I'd have a 12-hour shift at night, and I'd sleep during the day. And so the station was fairly large. Our biggest problem there was fire. That was what everyone was always very concerned about, because if those fuel bladders ever went, boy, that would be a big deal. So we had sort of a backup station that was located maybe a quarter mile away or something like that, so you could walk over in case a fire ever happened. But the pole is an odd place in that the wind blows around the pole rather than, so that means it's circulating around the pole, and that means at the pole itself there's not a lot of wind, which is really a blessing.
Well, that's nice. I can't imagine the temperature you're talking about, but then with a wind chill attached to it would be just insane, I would think.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, you're also, I got to make sure that I say this because it kind of came up there briefly. You're a former officer in the Army, and you were in the Signal Corps and communications. And can you talk just a little bit about that too? Share a little bit?
Well, I enlisted in the Army right out of high school because they would pay for me to learn another language. And so I picked Russian at random, more or less. I just thought, well, it's not going to be as hard as Chinese, but it's still sort of hard. So when I was, I'd say I attended the basic and intermediate Russian courses, which took almost a year and a half. And then I got an in-service ROTC scholarship that allowed me to use all my credits as sort of college credits, and I sort of finagled some other college credits and was able to go to the University of Washington and complete my first degree in Slavic languages and literature. And I thought, oh my gosh, I am so set. I'm doing exactly what everybody says to do. That's follow your passion. And I wanted to learn a language, so I learned a language. I was so excited about it. And then the military, in their great wisdom, decided they had too many female officers in military intelligence, which used language capabilities, which, you know, one could understand. They wanted to have kind of a balance. You don't want to have, you know, the women going into one, all going into one specialty. And so they put me in the Signal Corps, which I thought was the worst thing that ever happened to me in my entire life.
Oh, no.
I was so silly. at the time, it really was not a good thing because I was a terrible signal officer. I mean, I didn't know what a volt was or what an amp was. And, you know, you got a circuit, you got one wire that goes out. Why do you have to have another wire coming back? I mean, none of it made sense to me. And of course, I had no training whatsoever in math or science. And so this business with radio waves and so forth was just all like some sort of frou-frou magic to me. So you can imagine that when I was going out to tell my platoon how to lay out all these cables and hook into the radio systems and so forth, I was not very good at what I did. And I eventually transferred to become an assistant adjutant. And then when I went to get out of the military, though, for some weird reason, like, recruiters were not pounding at my door and saying, oh my goodness, we just have to have your Slavic languages and literature degree. And so I realized that I needed to stop following my passion, or at least start broadening out my passion and learn something that would actually get me a decent job that I could that I could enjoy and be more in control of my life with. And so that's when I decided to try to go back to the university and learn engineering, electrical engineering. And it was such a bizarre thing to do in that I was so bad at math and science growing up. So I started with remedial high school algebra and began slowly working my way forward, occasionally going out to work at sea and just do a lot of drinking, you know, the things the Russians do. Yeah, and but I think it really taught me a lot. You know, a part of it was I looked at the West Point engineers I worked with in the military, and they had great job prospects. They were really smart problem solvers. And it wasn't that they were these super smart people necessarily. It was that their training had helped them to be able to analyze things in a more analytical way. And I thought, you know, I want to try to do that too. And so that's how the military was fantastic for me because it gave me it forced me out of my comfort zone of, you know, I only like to learn languages. That's all I want to try to do. And it forced me to grow up and start saying, wait, what's going on in the greater world? Let's see if I can turn my attention and turn my brain so that I can have a happier life and career doing some more exciting things. And it turned out really well. And of course, the GI Bill was a great help in getting my second degree, which is in electrical engineering.
Which I just, it's so amazing to me because you go from this degree in Slavic languages and then decide, I think I want to do math and science, even though I've not really done it very much. And then you get multiple degrees in those areas. And you introduce this in the book, which I'm going to use this then as a segue into this. But that just is so amazing to me to go, I can do this. And you set out and you did more than do it. You went and get multiple degrees to include your doctorate. So.
Well, it makes it sound like I was really self-confident and that I could, you know, I just felt like I could really do it. But that's really kind of far from the case in that I always feel like a fake. I always feel like everybody else is smarter than I am and, you know, and I'm struggling to catch up. And sure enough, even when I was taking remedial high school algebra as I was trying to retool my brain, here I was 26. And I would look around me and there's all these people, especially when I got past that into the first year of calculus, and there's all these super smart young whippersnappers. and here I am sort of the flunky from when I was in high school. I'm way older and so forth. But what I now realize is that all of these times when I would feel like an imposter and a fake and really uncomfortable and I'm not sure I can do it, that was really helpful for me. It was the worst problem people have is when they are really cocky and they think they can do it. my students, when they come into my, like when I'm teaching stats and probability, the ones that come in and say, you know, I got this, I'm really good, they're the ones who are going to have problems. The ones who come in and say, I'm really not sure I can do this, I don't have the background, those are the ones that are more likely to be successful because they're uneasy, they are willing to change themselves as they need to, and they are actually paying attention to the environmental cues, like you did badly on this test, and it's because you didn't study right, not because the teacher gave a test that was a test question that was unfair. And so anyway, I think I've been very lucky to just have persisted through these sequences of, oh my goodness, I'm such a fake, I'm an imposter, I'm not as good, you know, and just kind of keep going seemed to work pretty well.
That's incredible. And it just comes out in, you know, in your book, which we're going to focus on now, we're going to shift to it. You tell a bit of the story and you just can see how you're learning how to learn along the way. And then coupled with the brain research and so forth, of the day and neuroscience, it just, being able to be persistent and to make that shift. What I love about it is it kind of helps throw away the idea that, you know, if you're not good at math, there are some things you can do to help you become this or whatever the subject is. Like, I mean, I can't imagine just going ahead and saying, yes, I'll go do Russian or I'll go do Chinese. You know, there's some things that obviously we might be able to set our minds to if we understand how we learn that can help us then do this.
Yes, precisely. And I think the biggest challenge that older learners have is simply that our lives are often so busy that it's harder to devote the kind of focused attention that you can sometimes when you're a younger person. And young people may be saying, well, I have a job and I've got this, and it's true. But even so, when you get older, it becomes much more apparent that you have so many commitments to family, to work, to, you know, to many, many sorts of things. It's just a little harder sometimes to put that careful, focused attention in that good learning can sometimes involve.
And I understand what you mean. You just had to ask me sometime how long it took me to get my doctorate. So, but with that being said, let's shift now to your book. It's called Learning How to Learn, How to Succeed in School Without Spending All Your Time Studying. Published this year. It's written with Terrence Sanowski and Alistair McConville. I love the format and layout. It even has pictures and drawings, which I think is too cool because this is a book about learning and it's easy to understand. I hope you hear how I say that because a lot of books about learning aren't easy to understand. They're written on such a level that you go, what? What? You know, and you need a translator for it. You probably need that your own translator right there. Might as well be Russian. You know, talk a little about the time and preparation that went into its design.
Oh, it is so difficult to make something super easy and simple. I mean, it's hard to describe. I've written papers for the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the Institute of Electronic Engineers, Bioengineering Journal, all sorts of, and it is tougher to write for kids than it is to write for, you know, highly advanced professionals. And you're right. Sometimes I will look at books on learning, and I just think, what are these people thinking? I mean, it's like they'll talk about all the things you need to do to be able to teach well, but they don't walk the walk themselves. They don't make the book readable. They don't make it practically useful. It's kind of like, well, you should know about neuroscience if you're a teacher, and here's the amygdala. The amygdala does, you know, and I mean, yes. It's like, so what? We want to know, what do we know from neuroscience that can really help us? And so it was a lot of fun. Some of this information is in my adult book, Mind for Numbers. And I had gotten lots of questions from parents and teachers. Why don't you have something for kids? And I thought, well, I'm not a kids writer. I can't do that. And then it occurred to me one day, and this is how dense I can be sometimes. It's like, well, why don't you collaborate with someone who can write for kids? Wow! What a breakthrough idea. And so I had met Alistair McConville when I was in England. He works at a private school there. And he has taught for years. And he has a humanities background. And I didn't know this, but Al, after I met him the first time, he always felt very bad that he didn't have any kind of science background. So after we met the first time and I gave a presentation at his school on learning how to learn, he went back to actually take the high school equivalent of like it's like a high school diploma specializing in chemistry. It's kind of along those lines. And he took the better part of a year to learn chemistry and actually sit the same examination as the students at his school sat. And he passed, and he did really, really well. So he wrote a chapter about his own experiences as an adult trying to inspire kids through his own efforts to learn things he thought he couldn't learn. And it's a wonderful chapter in the book. But Al and I kind of went back and forth with, I would write the first sort of draft chapter of something that involved heavy neuroscience. And Al would write more than ones that didn't go more heavily into the neuroscience or the cognitive psychology. But then we would switch and go back and forth with each other's writing. So it turned out really well. And then in the meantime, Terry, who is the Francis Crick Professor at the Salk Institute, he's one of only 12 living human beings who's simultaneously a member of the National Academy of Sciences, National Academy of Engineering, and National Institute of Medicine. And so Terry's a freaking genius. And so he would come and he would say, well, why don't you incorporate this image of brain-derived neurotrophic factor from Nature Neuroscience? And I'm sitting there going, oh, what? Yeah, how am I going to do that? And whenever he would do these seemingly wacky things, once I really sat and thought, there was always a way to do it, and it brought the book to an even more insightful level about what was going on, key ideas in neuroscience that are actually super easy to understand. And we're able to bring this great imagery into the book. So it's not only wonderful cartoons and drawings by Oliver Young, who also works at Bedale School along with Al McConville, but also some wonderful imagery from journals, from science. And you can actually understand it because the sort of the lead-in drawings are so, you know, make everything so clear. So it was actually altogether a wonderful collaboration. And I think the book turned out spectacularly well as a result of that collaboration.
Oh, it really did. And it's cool listening to you explain that collaboration because I'm always curious, you know, it's pretty cool to me that, first of all, people write books. Number two, it's amazing to me that when you talk about collaborating, when you have more than one person working on a book, sometimes they actually write individual chapters and then some editor brings it together to make it all sound like the same one person's writing it. And instead, it sounds like you actually have this really cool collaboration that really works well. And the book comes out in such a way that it is so, I strongly believe that an adult should read this because then they can understand how to help the kids more in their classroom, not just for the kids, because the primary target for learning how to learn is students, right? Kids?
Yes, that's exactly right. But it is so, I mean, adults, parents, teachers, caregivers of all sorts will learn so much that they have not seen before by reading the book that they would be, I think they would really love reading it as well, besides it's funny.
It is. And we're going to get into that in just a minute because there's just some cool aspects to it that, you know, it's funny because and I mean this to come out well, what I'm about to say. But when when you start reading a book about learning how to learn, you don't expect to want to continue reading. And I did. And it's like, this is cool. This is very neat. And there's certain aspects of the book that I'm going to get into in just a minute here that are part of that trigger that helps you want to go, this is cool. I want to see what happens next. I want to see what you're talking about next. And, you know, and it's so cool. And so one of the things that stood out to me, and I want to mention this, is at the end of chapter one, I love this statement. You say, get out a notebook or a piece of paper as you read the next chapter, take notes, answer questions, and make doodles with key insights. This will help you avoid mindless reading and help glue the new ideas into your brain. Can you talk about this and why it was included? And I just think this is the type of language that, you know, this is what makes it easy to use.
Well, I think if you know that a lot of teachers and administrators know about the learning process. And so for them, it's probably natural that I'm including these kinds of things to help people actively grasp those ideas, to do something that is where they have to do something. And as the book goes on, it becomes more and more apparent why you are doing these kinds of active exercises. We talk about, if you just look at a picture of a neuron, it's like so boring. Oh, here's the axon at the top, and we have the nucleus in the middle. And so instead, we introduce it with the metaphor of a space alien. And the axon is like the arm reaching out from the top, and then you have these dendrites are its legs. And space aliens apparently have lots of toes. Those are the dendritic spines. So they're not like humans. Of course, they're space aliens, so that's why they have these toes. But what happens is the axon reaches out, the bouton at the end of the axon reaches out to touch one of the toes of the next space alien or of the neuron. And so what happens is you start to build those connections when you are actively doing something. You start that little dendritic spine bursting out of the leg of of the neuron. And so people can actually see that. And if you just are passively looking at the page, you're not causing those neural connections of learning to actually, it's a structure that's happening in your brain. You can't see it, but we can show pictures of it. And so that's why it's important to be doing these kinds of active exercises as much as you can at the end of each chapter and kind of interspersed throughout the book in the chapters.
Oh, I love it. And it you know, just reminds us that is important to share. And here you are talking about it. And, you know, anybody who looks at any books that I and reading, I write all over the place and I draw pictures and I draw lines and I make connections. And it's cool to, you know, I think sometimes we have to give people permission to do that because it's.
Yeah. And, I couldn't agree more.
Which is cool. And that's why I like that that part there about this will help you avoid that mindless reading, which sometimes we can get stuck in. So look at some of the thoughts in some of the other chapters, like in chapter two. And I wish I could go chapter to chapter because this is all of it just had my brain just kind of connecting all over the place. So whatever it is, whether it's the dendrites or whatever was going on up there, is lots of sparks. Boom, 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 you know? But in chapter two, you're explaining the brain and the focused mode and the diffused mode. In this chapter, this sentence appears: pinball tables are kind of like your brain. Could you talk about this? Because this is where there's some cool pictures that come in, some drawings and things, and really make you, the reader, understand what you're talking about and what the importance of focused and diffused is all about.
Well, the underlying what's going on in your brain, there's like two different modes that your thinking can go in. And one of them is when you're focusing on something, and it's usually like it's centering mostly around a smaller portion of your brain. So let's say that you're doing a math problem. There'll be a task positive network related to math as you're working on that particular task. So you can think of it like if you're of a certain age, you'll remember that a pinball machine has this table with the rubber bumpers on it. And if that's in your brain, the rubber bumpers of that math area of your brain are kind of tightly, they're really tight together. And it's like your thoughts are bouncing around really close together there as you're doing that math problem. And sometimes when you have something, let's say you know how to do multiplication, you know, someone says do multiply 24 times 73. So your mind like bounces around that tiny little area of your brain for the most part. But if you're trying to learn something completely different or new, like let's say you know multiplication, but you don't know division, it's like you're going to be laying a pattern in a newer place in your brain to begin following, but you don't know how to lay that pattern there. And in fact, you don't even know how to use it once you lay it. And it's a very, when you're learning something new that's difficult, it can be really tough. And often you'll fall back on patterns you've already laid, for example, for multiplication when you're trying to do division. And it can be really, you get frustrated because you're not able to solve the problem. You're using the wrong set of patterns. So what often will happen when you get stuck, you get frustrated, you close a book, you walk away, and eventually your mind gets off of it. And once it gets off of it, completely off of it, so you're not, it's not lurking in the background of your thoughts, but you're off of it and you're maybe standing in the shower, going for a walk, or you're doing whatever. This other set of patterns opens up in your brain. And it's kind of like a new pinball table, but it's got really widely dispersed rubber bumpers. And in this mode, your thoughts can just bounce way more broadly. And so you can kind of start getting a new perspective on what you're working on. And that means when you do come back to focusing again on it, you have a different perspective. You're kind of able to shift your thoughts over to where you needed to be, and it begins to make more sense. Of course, there's more going on. There's consolidation processes that are taking place in default mode network operation and so forth. But you get the basic idea that when you're learning something, you focus, then you back away and going into these neural resting states, what I call the diffuse mode. Then you go back to focus. And learning involves going back and forth between these two different modes and using a metaphor to understand this, using these pinball analogies. In fact, using any kind of metaphor or analogy is often a great way to get a new idea across because you are building from what you already know into what you need to learn, and you're using the patterns you've already laid from what you already know to help get you there more quickly. Whenever the metaphor breaks down, throw it away, get a new one. But metaphors and analogies are one of the most powerful tools for learning.
That is so cool. And just, you know, the idea, because as a teacher in the classroom, one of the things that if you can use these then to help paint those pictures in the minds of the kids or to help them connect their knowledge with something that they know, I'm guessing that's where that would go if you're an adult reading this or listening to us.
That's exactly right. What I really want to do is show kids some of the key ideas that will help their learning go a lot more quickly. And incidentally, any teachers and parents who read this will also benefit from these ideas. I should also add that just as Al did a chapter in the book, Terry did a chapter, which is really fantastic, about how, for example, joining clubs and organizations really helped speed his learning and helped him to get a better grasp of, you know, how to move forward, even in his school pathways, you know, in his school career. So I think that also is another great chapter of the book. So we don't just talk about, you know, how the brain learns. We're also talking about just a variety of different ideas that can really help kids be successful, not only in their learning, but in their life.
Very cool. Some of the other little techniques that you have in the book are at the end of the chapters, you have these sections. And for example, one of them is called pause and recall, and one of them is called now you try. And this, what I love about this, and then there's a couple other sections we'll get to in just a minute, but the pause and recall and now you try, you know, the idea here is to get them to think and use, right?
That's right. That's right. And also one thing that kind of, I guess, that bothers me about very, very good books related to education in particular is I'll often read through a chapter and it can be tough to figure out what's the elevator version of this chapter. What were the key ideas that I have just read? Now, I can reread the whole thing, or I can sit there and take time to take careful notes through the chapter. But that's, you know, I don't necessarily have time to do that. And I think that it can be very, very helpful for readers to go through a chapter and then say, and look at this. Now, here's the key points. Of course, before they see the key points, they're asked to pause and recall the key points themselves. But if they're looking for, you know, what is this author really trying to communicate, I think it's very helpful to have a kind of an elevator version of the key ideas of that chapter, just to help you more easily encapsulate and create sets of links related to those important points, which, as we point out later in the book, those sets of links are actually vital to becoming an expert in anything.
So amazing. This is, I just think about stuff that I did as a kid to try and get through classes or to try and figure out how to study or prepare. I wish I had your book.
I wish I had it then too.
And you know, besides the pause and recall and now you try, you also have summing it up and checking your understanding. And you know what you just said a minute ago, you're right. I've read books where at the end of the chapter you go, now what was I supposed to get out of that? What just happened? What was the point? And
yes.
And I love this idea, you know, first of all, that doesn't happen in your book. You really get your point, but you do have this section where you sum it up. Here are the main ideas from this. And I love that.
Yep. Well, I guess pause and recall is trying to get kids to actually do that. And then summing it up is really where the summary it takes place. But between the two of them, it's so funny. I first had the summing it up before the pause and recall. And then one thing that we did, we had hundreds of beta readers on this book. And one of these astute beta readers said, you should not have the pause and recall after you've summed it up, because when you do that, people have it right in front of them. So do the other one first. And I just thought that's such a good idea. It is funny when you get in feedback from a lot of people, no matter how good your writing is, you will get some really, really useful, fantastic insights. And so those are dutifully acknowledged in the copious, you know, we had some tremendous help from kids and adults, teachers and people from all backgrounds, in just beta reading through the book and giving their suggestions.
That's excellent. That's cool to know that you had all those beta readers, because that I can imagine that feedback would help you catch what might be your blind spot, or the three of you, didn't think about that type of thing.
Yes, and the beta readers were from all around the world. They're learners from Terry's and my class, Learning How to Learn. So we have had getting close on 2.4 million students so far in the class, registered students. So so I send out an email to 1.3 million people every Friday.
Wow.
And so I asked for beta readers, and I had to be so careful because I didn't want to be overwhelmed with responses. So I was like, you have to be able to get back in a couple weeks. You need to have a child. But even so, we got hundreds and hundreds of beta readers and from all over the world. And that makes a difference too, because there's just great insights coming from Indonesia or France, or there's something about an international set of insights coming back that you get a much broader idea set than just within the U.S.
That's neat. I can only imagine if you put that out there to 1.3 million people. Yes, you have the potential of wow. Okay, didn't see this many coming.
yes, indeed.
So, I love the book. There are three chapters that I love the most, and I have to say, I was trying to figure out how to say that I liked one over the other, but I couldn't. So that's why I chose the three of them. And they're chapters 7, 8, and 9. And 7 is called School Bags, Lockers, and Your Attentional Octopus. Chapter 8 is Slick Tricks to Build Your Memory. And chapter 9 is Why Brain Leaks Are Important and How Not to Back a Car into a Ditch, which in my case would be how not to back your car into somebody else's car. And what I'd like to do is, could we talk about the attentional octopus and the working memory? Because that's what the three of them are building on there. And I was just wondering if you could do that for a second.
Oh, that is so important, because it also gives us a key to resolving the synthesis of the math wars. And what's really going on, what we've found from neuroscience, the metaphor that's often used by cognitive psychologists is that of slots of working memory, that you have used to think that you had 7 slots in working memory. That's what you can hold temporarily in mind. Like you get a code from Microsoft that you got to enter in order to get on Skype or whatever. So you're sitting there saying to yourself 9, 4, 3, 2, 5, 7 as you type it in, and you're holding it in your working memory. Now, we used to think you could hold about 7 things. Now we think it's like 4 things, but you often can group them together, which is why it's easier to hold them. But I prefer, rather than slots in working memory, I like to think of it as your attentional octopus that's got like 4 arms, or it depends. If you have a very powerful working memory, you could have 8 or even 9 arms on your attentional octopus. But what these do, these arms can, in some sense, reach out into long-term memory and grab sets of links that you have stored there by virtue of the fact that you've already learned something really well. So I think one of the easiest ways to explain this is with our wonderful daughter, Rachel, who was willing to model backing up a car really badly. So we took a video of her, and she's like backing it up crazily and then going off into the ditch. But when you're first learning to back up a car, it's really hard. Your whole working memory, all 4 arms of your attentional octopus in your prefrontal cortex, the front part of your brain, they are like working madly to figure out, do I look in the front mirror? Do I look in the side mirror? What about the other side mirror? Do I look behind me? But once you have figured out how to back up a car, it's easy. All you have to do is think, Oh, I want to back up a card. One arm of your attentional octopus reaches into long-term memory, grabs the set of links you have put there by virtue of the fact that you've learned to back up a car and you practiced a lot, and then you just connect to that set of links, and bzzz, you, all of a sudden, you just start backing up the car. And it's so relatively easy that you can even be checking to see if your seatbelt is fastened or listen to the radio. Your other arms of working of your attentional octopus are free. So I think using that attentional octopus explains a lot about why procedural fluency, for example, when you're learning mathematics, is so vitally important. We tend to think, oh, well, you just understand it, and that's all you need. And I still remember one student coming up to me, and he had taken an exam on circuits or something, and he flunked the exam, and it was all red line. He goes, I just don't see how I could have flunked this exam. I understood it when you said it in class. And I mean, it was just, this guy had heard for so many years that understanding was the golden key to learning that he thought that's all he needed to do. When now we know from neuroscience and cognitive psychology that to really understand something, you need to be practicing with it. And in fact, that understanding comes hand in hand with the practice, with the development of procedural fluency. You understand a little bit, you practice with it, or you may practice with it, and that helps with your understanding. You go back and forth, and you gradually build that set of links that are stored in long-term memory, kind of like a computer subroutine. And then what that does is when you are tackling a tough problem, if you have already kind of created sets of links that you can draw on to do some of that sub-processing, then your attentional octopus doesn't need to be holding so much in working memory to be understanding and working with what you're doing, and it's a lot easier to solve problems. So this is why procedural fluency is part and parcel of becoming an expert in any subject, you know, whether it's dance or martial arts, or you're learning a musical instrument, a foreign language, becoming a race car driver, whatever it is, you need to have a big library of these sets of links where you're procedurally fluent with those sets of links. And that offloads your working memory so you can work so much more easily with difficult new ideas.
And this is what's so cool about the book, is that it takes something that conceivably could be something that you do go, huh, about that, with between the images and the language that you're using, instead of going, huh, it goes, huh, I understand this. and I like that. That is so cool. So do you have a favorite part or section or chapter of the book?
You know, what you just pointed out with working memory, I think that's one of the most important parts of the book, because it does so much to explain where we need to be going as a nation in order to maintain our international competitiveness and viability in these important times where analytical skills, along with knowledge of language and culture, are all vitally important.
That's excellent. And one of the things I've mentioned this earlier, which is, I mean, I know the target audience are kids, but it's, to me, I think that adults should read it, and especially teachers and school administrators. I mean, what do you think would be a message to them about why they should take time to read this? I think part of it was what you just said.
Well, because it's a little bit like driving a car and never being told when you should gas it up or why you should change the oil. Or, you know, in other words, you're given this car, but you're given absolutely no operating guidance whatsoever. you can't operate your car very effectively. You make a lot of mistakes, and in long term, it's not a good thing for your car. And you could have done things so much more efficiently. I think it's a lot like that for your brain and for kids' brains. And if you learn these kinds of ideas earlier on, it just saves you so much frustration and also prevents you from thinking things like, oh, I'm just dumb because I don't get this right off the bat, instead of, oh, I just need to back off and let the diffuse mode sort of work away a little bit with this.
Excellent. I love learning how to learn, how to succeed in school without spending all your time studying. And before we finish up, and I can talk, I'm sorry, I've already kept you probably way longer than you wanted to talk with me, but I could keep you for hours because this is fascinating to me. If someone wanted to connect further with you, where would you send them?
Just go to my website, www.barbaraoakley.com. And you can connect with me. There's a contact, there's all my books and connections to the courses that Terry and I do. And so it's all pretty exciting stuff. We just love working on everything. And so we're really, really happy to help in every way we can to improve learning, not only in this country, but around the world, especially for disadvantaged students.
Excellent. And I will have links to your webpage as well as social media links and other such ways of finding out more information. So I got two questions I'd like to finish up with. And here's the first one. If you were given the chance to talk with 100 brand new teachers who haven't started teaching yet, what advice would you give them?
Oh, I'll read the book. Realistically, it will help you understand so much more about where your kids are coming from and what you need to do to truly help them. Not in the sense of, here's some neuroscience. Your students should be calm because stress is not good for them. This actually has pointed information about the biggest challenges that kids face. Like, I feel stupid when I can't learn this. I procrastinate because I don't know how to kind of get my act together. What do we do with that? Actually, procrastination is one of students' biggest challenges. So I just highly recommend reading the book because you'll get a lot out of it by doing so.
Excellent. And so here's my last question. Do you have a teacher in your past who made a difference in your life? If given a chance to say thank you, who would it be and what would you say?
Oh, I've had so many great, great teachers. I think probably one who has had a very powerful impact on me is Richard Felder and his wife, Rebecca Brent. Richard won the American Society of Engineering Education Lifetime Achievement Award, and he got me started. I attended this workshop called, I won this little scholarship in my first semester teaching where I could go off to an engineering education conference, and I somehow wandered by this one talk that was going to be given called student-centered learning. And I thought, well, that sounds really stupid. Aren't we supposed to be the professors who are up there professing? But for whatever reason, I walked inside and that talk, that 3-hour workshop really changed my life. As far as helping me to understand how to help students much more actively engage with the materials. So Richard Felder is one of the I think key fellows who's made an enormous difference in my own career, along with his wife Rebecca Brent.
Thank you. That's so cool. Thank you for sharing. Well, Barb, thank you so much for sharing Learning How to Learn, How to Succeed in School Without Spending All Your Time Studying. I love its layout and its content. It's easy to understand and to use. And what's so unique is that its information is helpful for kids, parents, teachers, and administrators. So cool. Just so cool. Thank you for joining us, and I wish you the very best.
Well, thank you. And until next time.
Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is excited to be a member of Voice Ed Radio. Voice Ed Radio, your voice is right here. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a proud member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. The opinions expressed on Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 are those of the guests and host. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions for classroom teachers and school administrators. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll share it with your friends.